And now, it's time for the Talk of the Northwest, the 9 to noon show with Greg Hughes on Highland Radio.
Hello, good morning to you. It's just approaching 6 minutes past nine on this Friday, the 24th of February, 2023, and it is another edition of the 9 till noon show. So much coming up on the show today. We've got our Friday panel joining us right now, which we look forward to chatting to, of course, a little later on. We'll be announcing our finalists for the Irish Music Month competition that we have running, and so much more besides. I'll tell you about it, excuse me, as the morning wears on. But let's crack right on with saying good morning to our guests, Michael White of the Green Party. Good morning, Michael. How are you keeping?
Good morning, Greg. I'm grand.
It's great to have you with us. Sam, we're also joined by, I wonder, are we? Pat McCart. Pat McCart, are you there?
Can you hear me, Greg?
I can hear you loud and clear. I feel like asking you for your votes for the artists of some Eurovision or other. But anyway, it's great to have you in with us, Pat. And last but not least, Councillor Liam Doherty, Sinn Féin, Councillor in the Stranraer Municipal District. Good morning to you, Liam. Great to have you on board.
Good morning, Greg. Good morning, Michael. Good morning, Pat.
Right, good morning. How are you?
Good to have you with us, as I say. Right, we'll crack straight on with some of the topics here. Michael White, Chair of the Green Party in Donegal. I mean, it's a year since the war in Ukraine begun. It's hard to believe. I don't know if it feels like twice as long or half as short. It's hard to comprehend, really. But it wears on, an incredible loss of life. Many people will ask, for what? Maybe that forms part of this conversation. Michael, there seems to be no end in sight, even though to some extent maybe we've come a little bit new used to the daily news of it.
Well, I guess most of us, when we saw the footage this day last year of the tanks rolling across the border and the helicopter attack on the outskirts of Kiev, most of us would have assumed it was game over within a week or so. So it's kind of amazing that a year later, Ukraine is still there. They're still in a pretty good position and they're strongly back. The other thing, given what happened when Russia invaded Crimea in 2014 and nobody really cared, it's also surprising. I don't think anybody predicted the European Union would react in the way it did, and so tightly and so emphatically. So that's all positive. But, you know, hundreds of thousands of people have lost their lives or are seriously injured now. And the question is, where does it go from here? And just from listening to commentators over the last few weeks, there's a few ways things could go. There's, you know, Ukraine can win this year, possibly. That's one opportunity. Or Russia could have some massive counterattack during the summer.
Just in relation to that, and I hope you don't mind me interrupting you, but in terms of, like, would the Chinese, for example, and others, allow Russia to be defeated by the West like this? Because, you know, we come at this from a Western perspective, and obviously we had diplomats from China or representatives from China meeting with their Russian counterparts recently. But if you think about it, you know, the notion is that the West can't allow Russia to win because he'll redraw the boundaries and where would it go from here? Conversely, you could say the same. Well, the likes of China and others, North Korea, can't allow the West to defeat Russia either. So I think the chances of your first scenario, and it was just a scenario, is as unlikely as, you know, an all-out Russian victory this year, for example.
That was my third scenario, Greg. You caught me.
Right, okay. Well, go on.
Yeah, so the Chinese, the Americans have intelligence this week. The Chinese are thinking about providing arms to Russia. That's where the biggest risk this year. It's a bad way. One scenario is where they just slang it out between Russia and Ukraine during the summer. But the worst possible scenario is where China starts to provide arms. The immediate reaction to that will be to cut China out of, say, markets in Europe. It'll really, really escalate very quickly from that. There's another scenario, actually. Either China provides arms to Russia or else China takes an opportunity to invade Taiwan. Those are both, you know, nobody's an expert on any of this. The one thing I would say, though, is that the reason that the war started in the first place last year is because Putin thought he could get away with it. He had every reason to believe that. He thought that because he got away with it the previous couple of times in 2008 and again in 2014. Now both he and the Chinese will know that if they do escalate, there's very likely to be a reaction. And that's a cause for hope, I think. Everybody's got a much more rational view of what's likely to happen. Now, it's partly because Biden's in the White House at the moment. That could all change in 2 or 3 years. But right now, the Chinese and the Russians will know that if they do something that it escalates, there's likely to be a reaction from both Europe and the States, which is, for me, is a cause for hope. So then you're looking at what could be a possible end state. As you say, the Russians can't be defeated in a sense they can be pushed back into Russia, but they could be defeated in the sense they're pushed back from some of the territory they took last year. Mm. Or
it seems the Ukrainians will not accept anything that doesn't include Crimea being returned to Ukraine. And it's a sad situation, and I think it is where we're at, is the only thing stopping this going, you know, exploding into something global is mutual destruction. I mean, that's the only thing, really, I think, that's...
The other thing about this, I don't want to hog all the speaking time, but Russia is no longer a superpower. Russia, as one American described it, Russia is a gas station with a nuclear bomb attached. Russia's economy is slightly smaller than Italy's, so it's not like the Second World War where you had Stalin, you know...
Yes, but if the West is fighting Russia in a proxy war in Ukraine, North Korea, China... Even maybe you could argue South Korea, they are also potentially fighting a proxy war in Ukraine.
What I mean is, there's a level of fear around this, but what I'm saying is Russia doesn't have infinite resources. It doesn't have the resources it had at the end of the Second World War. So, you know, it's not inevitable that you sometimes hear people sort of saying, you know, the massive land mass of Russia, they got, you know, unlimited numbers of troops. That's not correct. Yeah, they don't have unlimited numbers of resources. Yep. So,
and neither does the West either. And it's well documented at this point that, you know, particularly European countries are very close to exhausting, you know, their reserves. Who's to say this is part of a greater plan? Okay, thanks for that, Michael. Pat McCart, bringing you in on this conversation, of course. What say you?
I think, you know, it could be very interesting in the next couple of weeks, but it looks like the war could drag on for a long time, Greg.
Not good.
Not good. No, like what seems to be Putin seems to be think that he can he's some sort of czar, that he can bring the motherland of Russia, he can bring back in Latvia, Lithuania, Bulgaria, and that he can restore Russia to its, you know, the glory days of the 1950s or whatever. But the problem with that is, you know, I hear a lot of people saying the Americans and NATO are not, you know, sort of innocence and all this, and there's an element of truth in that. But the other side of the story, Putin's been in charge in Russia, Greg, for what, 22 years? Mm. All his opposition are either dead or in jail. Like, would you like to be living under a Russian situation? And by the way, I've listened to some people saying, you know, the Russians are getting an unfair deal, but go on, try it. And I'm not saying America or anybody else has been above board or a sort of guiltless here, but try go over to Moscow and protest about Putin's rule or about the war in Ukraine and see how you get on. So, you know, you have to take your... I don't know where you find the good guys, but I think it's quite evident where the bad guys are.
Yeah, but he enjoyed huge support, I presume not all brought a gunpoint at a recent rally yesterday, wasn't it? Now, obviously... the Russian people are, for the most part, being, you know, fed a narrative, so you could say they're being convinced in that way or other. But, you know, you talked about who's innocent, who's not innocent. I mean, it depends how far you want to go back. I'm not in any way being pro-Russian or whatever here. But I mean, we shouldn't forget either all the saber rattling and the moving of or the attempts to move, you know, NATO up to.
But if you want to go further back, Greg, I mean, the history between Russia and Ukraine goes back to the 1930s when they imposed a mass famine. Over 3 million Ukrainians died because of what the Russians did. They also committed mass murder in the 1937 Stalin trials.
All right, I get you. So we could just war. It depends on where you want to cherry pick the history from, I suppose, is what you're saying.
Well, it's a long history between the two countries. This is the outcome of it. You know, it's not just what's been happening between NATO over the last 30 years.
Okay. Liam Doherty, Sinn Féin councillor in the Stranraer Municipal District. Again, you know, like, I know there's the bigger picture here, but I can't help but think, and I think particularly with young sons, you know, and this is both young Russian people as well as young Ukrainian people, because a lot of the young Russian men and women are being sent to their deaths, perhaps, you know, under false pretenses as well. You know, whilst we sit here talking about it, there could be 1,000 more wiped out today on both sides, Liam. And for what? Is it for global peace? Is it Putin's ego? Is it Biden's ego? You know, sometimes I just wonder, what is this all about?
Yeah, as you were saying, it goes back a long way. There's a lot of history there. And, you know, for this to kick off just a year ago, as Michael said at the start, it was, you know, thought it was, you know, within a few weeks. I think Russia probably thought the same, that they'd go in and walk over Ukraine and just and take it over. But it's obvious Ukraine has stood up to them, but at a loss. You know, it's really, you know, I found myself, you know, seeing the kids out there, what they have to go through, and you're seeing them here, you're talking to them here, the ones that has fled and come for better refuge here. You know, it is a sad, you know, similar to ourselves, you know, like they're just ordinary, everyday people, and they're displaced. And, you know, how long is this going to go on for? You know, they don't know. They're living in hotels here and stuff. They don't know where they're going to end up. You know, it's a sad situation to be in for them. And you'd be hoping that they'll come to some agreement shortly, but the looks of it is going to drag on for another while yet.
And the hope being maybe that the Chinese might try broker something, but they're on a training exercise with Russia and South Africa today as we speak, so they're looking at this in the bigger picture. Pat, in terms of our neutrality, all right, the government has decided, not us the people, but the government has decided that we are politically non-neutral. You know, we're back in Ukraine. Military, yeah. We are neutral, all right? That's what we've been told we are. Now, of course, we are sending soldiers from the Irish Army over to train Ukrainians. They say it's to defuse mines and what have you. But does that really mean that we're no longer military neutral? If our army is training their army to fight in whatever form within Ukraine, we can't claim to be neutral anymore, can we?
No, Greg, I think our neutrality, remember, I think we were neutral on the side of the Allies during the Second World War. I think the same. I think there's a lot of hypocrisy in regard to our neutrality. Now, I am not saying, you know, that I disagree with what's happening right now. But if you're talking about the concept of neutrality, I don't think we're any longer neutral. Now, when American troops can land in Shannon and we don't inspect what's going on there during that whole thing in Iraq, we're without question, we're helping the Ukrainians nonstop. Greg, as you use your own analogy, if we're sending people over to help train an army, you know, how can we turn around and say militarily we're neutral? No, we're not.
Is that a decision should have been taken by government without consulting its people?
Absolutely. Well, apparently any change to our constitution, there should be a referendum, unless they've slipped in one that
I don't think we're constitutionally neutral. I did look at this one time before. I'm not sure it's actually, I think there's, I don't believe we are constitutional. Michael, do you know the answer to that?
Yeah, I think the triple lock, it doesn't require a referendum, but it requires agreement of the Oireachtas. So I think what you're saying is true. We're becoming non-neutral. I mean, the kind of neutrality is really introduced by Eamon de Valera for really practical, pragmatic reasons to protect Ireland back then. And it's still, the reasons he had back then are still true today. Basically, he was afraid that the country would be dragged into unnecessary wars. Or, for example, nobody in Ireland would have wanted to be dragged into the Iraq war with the Americans. Most Irish people wouldn't want to be dragged into any war with most of the Republican presidents of the last 40 years. And that's still a danger. Mm. You know, arguably, the war that's being fought in Ukraine at the moment could have been avoided if the Germans, French and British had got their act together.
But Michael, if this being framed as us going over training them to defuse mines, that means it doesn't have to come before the dole for a decision.
That appears to me to be a technicality. I think it appears that way to you too. And certainly the Russians aren't going to interpret that as being neutral. They're going to interpret that as helping their adversary. So, you know, we'll slip in. I think one way or the other, neutrality is going to have to be discussed. In practical terms, we know Ireland is getting bigger economically. We're the same size economically as Austria or Hungary. We're bigger than Denmark. Those countries and Finland, we're bigger economically than Finland, but our army is very badly underfunded. We are exposed to more risks than we were, as we saw last year when the Russian Navy was going to go around the coast. Mm. We need to decide, are we going to rely on the English to fly overhead to protect us from things we can't see? That's a discussion that we do need to have.
But you see, Pat, too, you know, we talk about information wars and propaganda, and I know you talked about what life in Russia is like, and I referenced the fact that, you know, their state-controlled media really tells the Russian people what to do. I'm not saying it's on the same scale, but we have our own government here trying to tell us that we're neutral when I think clearly we know we're not. You know, they're telling us that to our faces.
But Greg, at least we can have a discussion of it. Greg, I was watching Putin's long address to that Politburo, whatever the hell they call it, the plenipotentiary group, or, you know, that group they had, I think it was Tuesday morning. And you watch the body language of the people in that audience. I can bet there's one, apparently there's only one news feed that goes out to the wide world, but there are cameras all over the place. And I would bet they were watching like hell, the people in that audience, to see their body language, to see their reactions, and see how quick they clapped. You know, Greg, you have to ask yourself, a man who's been in power for 22 years, you know, the message all the time, it's a special military operation, still, you know, and I was reading, believe it or not, a rare book by a guy called Woods, the former U.S. Secretary, and John Bolton, sorry. And he basically said, Putin just lies straight to your face. And he says, blatantly does. And, you know, the whole situation in Russia now is Putin is basically a dictator. He's telling his people, you know, he's barefaced lies. He's telling them it's a special military operation to rid Ukraine of Nazis and so on. And there's no way in the wide world that's what it's about. It's about he wants to reclaim territory. He has some skewed view of Russian history that he wants to claim back to the glory days. And he did. By the way, he lied. His ambassador lied straight to our Doyle when he told them that there'd be no invasion. Mm-hmm. There was 400,000 or something troops amassing on the borders, and he told the world that there'd be no invasion of Ukraine. You sort of go, right, why should we believe a word that comes out of his mouth?
Yeah, and but we're being told we're neutral, and as I say, I'm not saying they're the same things, but I get you. Liam Doherty, do you have any concerns with, and it being phrased as, you know, we're helping them to defuse minds, and I suspect it's to avoid this having to be brought up in the Dáil, and maybe it's a conversation the opposition don't want to be drawn into either, so it might suit them to keep quiet. Have you any concerns about the fact that we aren't really neutral any longer? Politically, we've already stated we're not, we being the government. And now militarily, we are sending the best of the best from our army over to train the Ukrainian army for war with Russia on Ukrainian territory.
No, I think we've lost our neutrality at this stage. I think the government is keeping it in a grey area where it's, you know, send them over to defuse bombs, landmines, whatever. I think they're avoiding having a debate on it. I think that's, you know, as I say, they're keeping it in that grey area where they're saying, no, we are neutral, we're not that. And for having bringing Ukrainians over here and housing them here, to me, that's not been, you know, I don't think that would break the neutrality, but I think it's you know, it's humane to do that. As I say, I feel as if the government's keeping it in a grey area. And I think it is something that should be discussed, and it's something that ourselves and Sinn Féin probably should be raising now, you know, at this stage, you know.
Like, I think it's a fundamental thing that the people might like some level of consultation, or even an opportunity for those that they elected to have the conversation in the Dáil. Would you welcome that, Michael?
Yeah, I do. I would. And actually, it's not, the question isn't just whether we're neutral or not. If we decide we're no longer neutral, that means we have to start spending a lot more money on our army, and it changes what we do with our economy. I think we're heading into a world where that might be necessary. It depends how things go this year, but the world's a lot less straightforward than it was 2 years ago, and it's going to become unpredictable, and we're going to have to decide, or we may not even be given the choice. I think the circumstances where we could be dragged into, say, a number of European allies requiring our assistance, or us as part of the EU being dragged into something, that likely, it's not inevitable, but it's more likely now than it was this time last year. We've got an army of less than 10,000. They're badly underfunded. The equipment's terrible. You know, no effective air power. Those are all things we need to talk about, and we will have to make a decision as a country, not just as some politicians. The country as a whole needs to have this discussion and decide, how do we protect ourselves? Are there alliances we can get into that will protect us? What happens next? But I think the days of where we kind of got a free pass over the last 50 years, where the Americans and the French and the Brits looked after what was happening in the east of the continent, and we didn't spend any money on our army. I think those days might be coming to an end.
All right, Pat McCart, finally, before we take a break and move on, you know, there's been talk about a European army, Ireland being part of it for an awful long, long time. And there are those out there, and I think they could probably make a strong argument that, you know, to that old saying, never waste a crisis, that this might be used an opportunity to soften opinion by being a little bit involved in training the Ukrainian army to full-blown being part of a European army.
Yeah, I've got to agree totally with Michael on that one. You're dead right, Greg. You never waste a crisis. And now there, I presume there'll be some hawks in the European community who will be saying we need our own protection. Now, it is a wee bit frightening when you see the Chinese and the Russians cozying up. China, of course, has got its own interests in Taiwan, and there's been all sorts of arguments going on with the Americans. The Americans have sent their fleet out by the Taiwan, and they said they will protect Taiwan. So the Chinese are flexing their muscles and telling the Americans, you know, back off, mind your own business. And now, if the Chinese start supplying the Russians with ammunition in the war in Ukraine, we've got, as Michael rightly points out, we've got a different situation. And then it's become very volatile. What happens in Europe next year about gas and all the rest of it? So we're looking down the barrel of a very strange gun these days, Greg. So the world has changed from this time last year. Like, we never thought there'd be a war like this on Europe again. You know, at the end of 1945, we thought all things would be sorted out over a diplomatic table with negotiations. The last thing, a full-on invasion, you know, this is a serious war.
But is this not really an end of the status quo in that, yes, we're talking about, you know, what's happening in Ukraine, but there's obviously a redrawing of boundaries or, you know, a power in this world now. You know, the Chinese are looking on it, and the Americans are looking on, and Russia. To some extent, you start wondering, is for all what Russia's doing, are they going to be a puppet of some sort or another in a wider,
keep in mind as well, there's a lot of saber rattling in regard to nuclear war as well. But Putin has said on several occasions now that if Russia is under an existential threat, that he wouldn't rule out using nuclear weapons. That's a whole new language that we haven't heard previously. You know, no one's, I've never heard any leader before saying, hey, if things come back, come to the worst, we'll start using, and by the way, he didn't use the word tactical the last day, he just said nuclear weapons.
All right, Pat, thank you very much for that. That's Pat McCart, former editor of the Derry Journal. We've got Michael White, chair of the Green Party in Donegal. And we're also hearing from Councillor Liam Doherty, who's a Sinn Féin representative, of course, in the Stranorlar Municipal District. We'll be back with more very shortly. Just to remind you that we want you involved in the conversation as well. Of course, WhatsApps and texts to 086 60 25000, 086 60 25000, or if you prefer to call 07491 25000. The Chief Constable of the PSNI will meet with Stormont leaders later as one of his senior officers remains fighting for his life in hospital. A fourth man's now been arrested in connection with the attempted murder of Detective Chief Constable John Caldwell. He was shot in Omagh on Wednesday night. The 22-year-old was detained in Coal Island in the early hours of this morning. A dissident Republican group, the New IRA, is believed to be behind this attack. I'll start with you, Liam, if that's all right. Widespread political condemnation of this, and in our conversations yesterday, you know, in the forefront of my mind is just a new generation of young people getting a look through the into the past and having a real experience of stories they may have heard from their parents or grandparents is kind of the thrust of what I was saying yesterday. Your reaction to this news?
No, I think it's disgraceful what's happened there. And I would like to just, first of all, my thoughts and prayers are with the DC, John Caldwell, and his family, and hopefully he'll make a full recovery on this. It's unacceptable. You know, there's no place in society now for this. It's in the past and that. And, you know, to shoot someone in front of their own child and amongst other children is just really dragging up bits of the past again, and it's just, it's totally disgraceful, and it's unacceptable. And it's, you know, it's hopefully they'll have, you know, they've arrested a few guys and stuff. Then hopefully they'll get perpetrators of this, and justice will prevail for them. But it's unacceptable, and there's no one I don't think would like to go back to the way it was.
Yeah, and most saying it's just not going to happen. Pat McCarthy, obviously, I'm sure you'd echo what Liam said there, and in your own words, of course, and maybe talk about the potential, you know, implications beyond the awful act, if there are any, in your view, Pat.
Yeah, Greg, you know, I don't understand where these people are coming from at all. I read there the guy, the Sunday Times security editor, whose name, escapes me at the minute. He said he interviewed the leader of this group about 2 years ago, and the guy said he admitted totally that there's no way they had a political purpose. They were basically just keeping sort of the old tradition of physical force alive. Now, Martin McGuinness and Gerry Adams and people like that said, and their raison d'etre was that when they were young people, there was no avenue that you could get sort of an anti-discrimination bigotry and all that sort of stuff, and that 50 years of unionist rule, and then when the civil rights went on to the streets, they were battened off the streets. But they worked and they got the peace process up and running, and they got the Good Friday Agreement. And Martin McGuinness and Gerry Adams are on the record nonstop, and, you know, of saying we have a vehicle now. So why the need for this? Greg, you can only condemn these people. There's no viable reason whatsoever for anyone for doing this. Now, what happens next? But Greg, though, I should point out a couple of about a year ago, I met a well-known sort of dissident Republican, and he said to me, "No, it's all this thing about the fall of Stormont, the refusal to elect, this thing about the protocol and the refusal of the DUP." And then, of course, there was the sort of bit of saber rattling about the Loyalist Command Council, about the Loyalist community being very unhappy, and that there was all this sort of stuff. And he was basically saying, if they want to start the war again, we'll start again. And that sort of worried me, because I thought, we've been down this road before, so do people not learn anything?
Yeah, it's a question that kind of answers itself, I suppose. Michael White.
Yeah, I suppose just to reiterate what Liam and Pat said. I mean, the only positive that's come out of it was there was a joint statement by Michelle O'Neill and Jeffrey Donaldson and Doug Beattie and the other leaders like Naomi Long. So all of them together issued a joint statement, which is really unusual, particularly over the last year, really condemning it. So that's a positive thing that came out of it. The other thing to be pointed out, like I detest this crap. It's fascist where there's a democratic avenue open. Some idiot goes out with a gun and tries to shoot somebody. But I don't believe this is really political anyway. These guys aren't spring chickens. Like, the ages of the guys arrested, they're 38, 45, and 47, old enough to have some cop on. It's a disgrace.
Obviously, this policeman's investigated 80, 90 murders. Do you believe then this is more the motivation is revenge?
Yeah, he's putting the heat on them. I'd say that's more of the driver of it. And also, 10 years or so ago, when somebody made a similar attempted murder, Martin McGuinness came out and called them traitors. And I'd agree with that totally. Guys doing this, they're damaging the future of Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland, and I hope they get caught and get nailed for it.
Yeah, Liam, we heard what Pat was mentioning there about, you know, concerns that something like this could escalate. He never quite said that, but you know what I mean, in his conversations in the past. In a way, is it possible that incidents like this enforce the fact that the majority don't want to go back there, and actually maybe to some extent, I'm trying to use my words carefully here because I'm conscious that there's a man fighting for his life, but in a way it reminds us that maybe we are in a better place when we have this unanimous condemnation of this. So in other words, rather than us falling backwards, it might strengthen where we're at as we move forwards, Liam.
No, I think you're right, Greg. I think it will. It does strengthen it. You know, there's no way it's going to go back to the way it was. No one's going to have the support of that. And, you know, the guys have done that is never going to, you know, get support again. The people sees, the people in the North and South both sees the difference it is with peace and what can be done. You know, 20, 30 years ago, people didn't see nothing else. All it was battling one side against the other. But people see now the peace, the way that you can, you know, there's no border, there's a border there, but you can just drive over to Derry or whatever. And there's no way it's going to go back. You know, the people won't let it go back. And people will, you know, as Michael said, that joint statement this morning, you know, it shows the, you know, the strength that's there.
Pat McCart, maybe one of the, if we were ever to go back, one of the main causes of that might be a political vacuum. And I imagine maybe the conversation you had with that person, you know, a year or so ago was in that context. You know what I mean? That there's no...
That's one of the problems, Greg. You see, and by the way, I'm trying very hard not to justify in any shape or form these people because I
same
really
as yeah. So that's what.
But you see, a lot of people were told years back the way the politics would work, that we could work together, and that we could resolve our difficulties. These people will now point out that Stormont is a joke. Power sharing is a joke. Brexit has done all sorts of damage. International treaties are not worth the paper they're written on. And that's been their experience. And they're going to use what's been happening in recent times. You know, what does they say, Greg? Nature abhors a vacuum. And there is a vacuum in the north at the minute. And there's a lot of resentment and there's a lot of division.
Well, I'll stay with you, Pat, because we seem closer than ever to some sort of an agreement that may or may not, because there's a few players in the game here. Obviously, there's a DUP and there is that group of Tories, the ERG, isn't it?
Yeah.
That are interested in no deal in the north. But as I say, the mood music seems to be that there could be some agreement between the EU and Britain. Are you optimistic of a return to power sharing in Northern Ireland?
No, I was some time ago, but not so much anymore. I watched, there was a video there in circulation of Jim Allister saying, no matter what happens, no self-respecting unionist could possibly go and serve under Sinn Féin as Deputy First Minister. The Sinn Féin are a party that don't want Northern Ireland to exist. So for any unionist to serve as a deputy to that sort of party is, basically, to use the word, traitor. Now, as you might ask, but Jim Allister's not a big player, but Jim Allister is seeming to be dragging the DUP by the nose. Himself and Jamie Bryson and the Loyalist Community Council seem to be setting a lot of the agenda for the DUP. And you sort of sit back and say, I sometimes wonder, is this, Greg, I'll simplify this. See the whole issue. Colm Eastwood of the SDLP was on recently and he said, no one had ever mentioned the European Court of Justice to him in any shape or form until it was dragged out at the last minute by the DUP to oppose the protocol. So, suddenly it's the major issue. So do the DUP at any stage want to serve on as Deputy First Minister to a Sinn Féin First Minister?
All right, well,
is that what this is all about, really?
Perhaps, but Michael White, democracy is at stake here, because if the scenario comes to pass whereby it's very, very clear that the DUP are not going to go into power again with Sinn Féin for that very reason, there might be a test of really, the will of the people in Northern Ireland. They might not accept that. If there's no legitimate reason, if their aim, if their concerns have been to a great extent met, I'm not sure really that argument that Pat puts forward, and it's quite likely that that's the way it will pan out, would work for them.
Unlike Pat, I'm a bit more hopeful. So I tell you, the reason I'm hopeful at a bigger level, Joe Biden wants to come to Ireland in April to celebrate the 25th anniversary of the Good Friday Agreement. I think there'll be a huge amount of pressure on the English to try and get it sorted. That's one thing. Secondly, during the week, Rishi Sunak met with a lot of Northern Ireland business leaders, and the quote from The Guardian, they were saying that they were impressed by his command of the detail of their problems with customs, VAT, state and tariff, blah, blah, blah. The point is that Johnson, not even the Northern Ireland secretaries over the past 4 years showed any knowledge of the detail of the agreements. Even the guy that negotiated the agreement didn't seem to understand it. So Rishi Sunak seems to be more on top of the detail. Pat's point about Jim Allister driving the DUP to an extreme, there is that group, and there's the ERG group and the Conservatives that would like to screw everything up. But I think it depends. For me, I think the Americans will set some of the context. The Europeans are obviously driving this too. Britain does depend a lot on the services exchange with Europe, and that's not yet being finalised. If the English do reopen this, the Europeans will retaliate, and they know they will retaliate. So I think that at a high level,
I understand
Michael's point, but the fact that Biden's coming here doesn't mean that the DUP goes back into. No, they can have an agreement between the EU and the UK. that doesn't mean for a second that the DUP are going to set up re-engage with Stormont.
And let's not forget their language either, wasn't it? They said that Biden, a couple of months ago, they said Biden could be coming over to celebrate the death of the Good Friday Agreement.
I guess the alternative then, and I know Liam might want to get in here, but the alternative will be if Stormont never goes back, then you're going into either joint authority or direct Westminster rule. Direct Westminster rule isn't a viable alternative in the long run either. So I would have thought that whatever the DUP say in public, Geoffrey Donaldson and his colleagues will want to get their hands back on the cash box at some point. They had.
It'd be very hard for them to make an argument not to go into power purely because they couldn't serve under Sinn Féin. I think that would be a hard line to sell. Now, obviously, they could frame it in different ways. But Liam, your views on this, and we'll come. But I want to get Pat back in as well, of course. But we want to hear from you as well, Liam.
I think myself, I don't know if you could ever really please the DUP, but I know they are using the protocol as an excuse here. You know, call a spade, like they don't want to serve with Sinn Féin. They don't want to serve under Michelle O'Neill. And I think it's totally wrong. Michelle O'Neill was elected and in the position of First Minister. At this stage, Michelle O'Neill should be serving as the First Minister. And it should be, you know, they need legislation passed there. They need, you know, there's a waiting list there. There's different, you know, the cost of living costs there is. I mean, the people in the north need Stormont to open.
I'm not being facetious, but I've got news for them if they think a government changes any of that because of the experience here in the Republic. Yeah. But I do take your point in terms of allocating funds that are available and all that kind of stuff. Pat McCart, just in your view, and I'll bring you all in again, of course, in terms of the tail wagging the dog, right? Who's the dog and who's the tail between the ERG and the DUP?
It's the DUP at the minute.
Are they the dog or the tail?
Greg, I'm sorry, I'm not even sure. The ERG are saying they will agree with whatever the DUP want. So Greg, you've lost me. I'm not sure which one that makes them, which one the dog and which one the tail.
Yeah, I get you. All right.
So basically, our ERG said unless it's acceptable to the DUP, they will not go along with it. And so, by the way, the London Times, I think on Wednesday, sort of changed tack. They said Rishi Sunak should override the objections of the ERG and the DUP. They described the DUP as not being reliable allies to the Conservative Party, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So there seems to be a change, and there seems to be a reality that dawning that the UK badly need a deal with the EU trade deal.
Well, that's it, Liam, you see. I think Sunak has a blank check from Labour so that, even if there is some resistance within the ERG group, that he can get this over the line and remain pretty strong in his power. Very quickly, the DUP could find themselves, you know, isolated. I mean, if the ERG are defeated on this, does anyone really want to hear from them any further? Do you know what I mean? So you could find the DUP under a great deal of political pressure to say, with everyone saying, look, you've got pretty much what you wanted. Everyone's voted in this direction. Now it's just up to you. Like, as I say, they could find themselves very quickly, very isolated, Liam, do you think?
Yes, I think it is. It's starting to get to that point where their backs are going to be against the wall and they're going to have to do something. They're going to have to come out straight and say that they don't want to be in power with Sinn Féin, but that's not going to work with the people. The people, you know, they're letting the people down the north, the DUP, you know, and they're shooting themselves in the foot. Constantly,
and shooting everybody else in their foot as well. It's not just their own foot, I suppose. Michael, politically, right? So, I mean, obviously, all political parties strategize and what have you. The DUP now are behind Sinn Féin, obviously, because Sinn Féin would get the front seat. But they're not going to change that out of power, are they? So, if they do have aspirations of maybe turning that tide, it's going to be. Isn't it in government making decisions, being able to go to people's doorsteps and saying, look, this is what we can deliver? Do you know, it's not in the DUP's interest if what they are afraid of is being second fiddle to Sinn Féin. It's not in their interest to be out of power then. That wouldn't make much sense.
Yeah, no politician wants to be out of power for long term. What I think in the short term, though, they're trying to, as Pat pointed out, that Jim Allister is driving them at one point. The DUP seem to want to shore up their support among the more conservative unionist groups. Also, for them to grow, really, they'll have to try and absorb more of the Ulster Unionist Party it doesn't look like the DUP ever plans to try and get some of the middle ground, you know, like the Alliance supporters. But politicians want to have access to power, and they want to have access to finance to change things. I would have thought that would be the inevitable driver that will eventually cause an agreement. And also, we need to remember that there were genuine concerns among unionists about the imposition of a border along the Irish Sea. So some of the stuff that they were saying wasn't just to be blood, you know, a bloody nuisance. They were actually articulating concerns that the unionist community had. If the UK government could sell to them that the agreement they've come to with the EU resolves all of those issues and helps the DUP sell it to the more extreme members of their party, you might get it across the line. Bertie Ahern this week just saying that's... be cautious and proceed with caution because you need to get all your ducks lined up in a row. His view is that you're not going to get something done this week or next week. It's going to take a bit more time to get it finished up.
Right.
But he seems hopeful that it can be achieved.
All right. It's interesting that you're quoting Bertie Ahern on that one. It's very interesting. Pat, but listen, I know what you've been described as being less optimistic on this, but listen, your knowledge and experience can't be ignored in that regard. So if the situation plays out as you fear it might, what happens next then? So what is the... How do things move forward, if at all, if the DUP resists this then?
Well, I think Michael might have already alluded to it. I think what's happening next, if Stormont doesn't come back, what happens is a direct rule, but it would be a direct rule with a more green tinge, I would think. I don't think a joint authority is on at the minute. The unionists would go absolutely ape if there was an attempt right now to introduce joint authority. So if Stormont doesn't come back, Greg, the Secretary of State, for years when I was on my other life, as editor of the Journal, I remember you used to go up to Hillsborough and places like that, and you'd meet a whole plethora of British ministers. They were making all these decisions. You know, there used to be a full sort of cabinet. There was the Secretary of State, and then there'd be seven or eight various MPs from the quote-unquote the mainland making decisions for Northern Ireland. I think I would think Sinn Féin and the nationalist community would have serious objection to direct rule. But if Stormont doesn't come back, that's what reality we're going to have.
What if this might be a scenario that can't play out? But what then if the British government start trying to put a bit of pressure on by starting to suggest that maybe there could be some joint direct rule?
Oh, that's going to have to come. No, I don't think it's going to happen overnight.
Well, that would be very hard for the DUP to contemplate, I'd imagine.
Yeah, but the reality is, right, let's go back to Jim Allister. The thing, it's floating around social media. He was speaking at some private do or other, and he's saying very clearly, no self-respecting unionist could serve under Sinn Féin. So, right, if he is reflecting what's happening on the ground, and by the way, he got a massive round of applause, the LCC, the Loyalist Community Council, came out with a quite strong statement the last day. Jamie Bryson, who seems to be the spokesperson that's on every media outlet now in Northern Ireland for Loyalism, he's saying...
Which is really quite remarkable, actually, because...
He got 176 votes or something.
Exactly, and he's constantly platformed as if he's the voice of unionism, particularly by Mr. Nolan, it has to be said.
Yeah, he was on Nolan again the last day. And I'm sitting going, you know, they're talking about dissident Republicans.
He's on the Claire Burns show as well, isn't he?
Would a distant Republican who got 176 votes be allowed on an ISIS?
But you know what I thought interesting about that? Sorry, Pat, because I'm distracted. Yeah. But about Nolan's, I can't remember his name
Stephen.
I can't believe that Stephen Nolan platforming Mr. Bryson in Northern Ireland. All right, that's fine. I was listening to Five Live one evening at 11 o'clock, you know, across Britain and Northern Ireland, and who comes on? A loyalist framed as a unionist spokesperson.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, wow, does the general population know that a person who couldn't muster 200 votes is being wheeled out as the voice of unionism? I thought that was... I thought it was a bit irresponsible, I'll be honest with you.
Greg, he's been given a serious platform. And each of the people seem to be leading the DUP by the nose. And if this happens, so our democracy has been subverted by people who cannot get elected.
But also, it's not just by them. It's the people and the BBC making the editorial decision to enable him to do that. And that BBC Northern Ireland, there are some questions to be answered. If you read the book about the Cash for Ash scandal, they talk about
Sam McBride.
Somebody from the BBC and somebody from the DUP holding a prayer service before a programme started. It's, you know, anyway. Does it happen in RT? Does it happen in Highlands?
Greg says prayers every morning.
I don't know what to say to that. No comment? I don't know. Come here. Listen, thanks very much for that. We'll be back with more from Liam, Pat and Michael after these. Caller says, unionists will never ever serve under Sinn Féin First Minister. There's no power sharing in Northern Ireland unless it's under unionist rule. The quicker that's accepted, the better. Another, hi Greg, could you please ask Michael White, who is the Green Party local area representative in Donegal, to explain the reasons behind the huge increases in the price of wood pellets over the last year, which have doubled in price, and what are the Greens doing to help people sustain this increase? The price went from €800 to €1,600. They believe this is price gouging. I'm not sure if you can answer specifically about wood pellets, Michael.
And I'll try and find out. I just know there's been a general increase in the cost of timber, lumber and other wood products, but I can't answer to that specific question.
What about this one? It's now become a luxury to heat your home. We're being forced into poverty thanks to the Green Party's politics. I think, in fairness...
That's not correct. Eamon Ryan's the one that introduced the 200 quid credits that we've got. So there have been two so far and another coming in March. So the reason we're being forced into paying high price bills is because Putin invaded the Ukraine and the gas prices went up internationally. Those prices are beginning to come down now, so energy prices should reduce.
Yeah, Pat, it's taken a while, isn't it, for the prices to come down, and then we're sold this pup that, you know, all the energy companies hedged long, long in advance, and it takes forever for wholesale prices to feed down to the customer and blah, 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 blah. Do you ever feel we're just being treated like mushrooms, if you know what I mean?
Absolutely. The international markets, yeah. What's happened in the last year, that Shell, BP, those guys are creaming it. That's ridiculous. And we should get the money. That windfall tax should be taken off them. Also, the European energy prices are tacked to the gas prices. That's what caused the big problem last year. When gas prices went up, even though we don't use that much gas in comparison to other products, all of our prices went through the roof. That needs to be changed, and apparently, though, it's going to take 2 years to get it sorted out.
All right, okay. We don't really have time to move on to anything else before the break. So, Liam, I'll just ask, are you in a sauna? No. You look like you're about to whip that polar neck off and throw some water on the... What was the first mistake you made on a Friday? I put on a polar neck. Okay. Pat, I haven't seen you at all, but listen, it's good to hear from you. You're keeping good, generally speaking, I hope.
Thanks very much, Greg. I certainly am. Thank you.
All right. Okay, Pat, listen, thanks so much for your time as always and your experience and expertise. It's very valued. Thank you. Take care of yourself. Liam, good to have you on the show. Look after yourself. Have a great weekend. And last but not least, Michael White, always good to have you on as well. Take care of yourself. See you soon.
Thanks, Greg.
All right. Okay. And that was our Friday panel for this Friday. 086 60 25,000 to get your say in on that. As I say, busy show coming up. Later on, we'll be talking about a Friends of Letterkenny Hospital fundraiser. Dr. James McDade will be joining us in Studio 2. He's about to be honoured with a stand being named after him, which is a wonderful honour. Later on, we are going to be chatting to some of the people behind Kinky Boots. A lot of excitement about it coming up in On Green on Theatre. Really excited to be unveiling the four finalists for the Irish Music Month, and we'll be telling you a little bit more about that and how that competition will work. But we've got four entrants, and there are four really, really, really strong finalists. Paul and Jimmy will be joining us after 11 to go through all that with us. But let's take a break for the news and obituary notices now.